Chapter 9, Meditation Garden.
Where I'm at right now in my grief, it changes. It changes weekly. Sometimes I ebb and flow. It's all over the place. There's about 600 different things you're going to go through. Some at all at the same time, some once a week, one maybe 24 hours. This is what I'm in right now. This is what's happening.
The night before my daughter was born, my husband and I and my parents headed out to a Holiday Inn in the Mojave Desert right off the 15 freeway to wait for Tupelo's arrival. Our surrogate was to be induced the following morning. We all had dinner with her, me, my mother, and my father and husband, then headed back to the hotel. Next morning, Tupelo was born via C-section. In the rush of it all, I hadn't had time to text or talk to my mom, and I had no idea where she was. But when we were walking the baby to have her Apgar test, we bumped into her. My mom had been looking for us. She wasn't even allowed in the area where we found each other. But in her typical way, she had snuck in and intuitively found her grandchild. She looked at Tupelo and the first thing she said was, Ben brought me to you. When we came home from the hospital, my mom and dad would do the 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift together, so Ben and I could get some sleep. There were a few brief months of joy, filled with the new little blessing in our lives. My mom would call Tupelo our little light, would look in her eyes and say, bless her sweet little feisty heart. She's like a fairy tale creature, a little fawn. At Thanksgiving, when my sisters, my mom, and I went for a walk outside my mom's house in Calabasas, my mother wouldn't let anyone else hold the baby. As we walked that day, we discussed our options for Christmas. Tahoe, Utah, Hawaii. To the latter, she said, yuck, a hot Christmas is my worst nightmare. Every year, she just wanted snow. At the time, I was working in Canada, so I suggested we all head to Whistler in British Columbia. She loved that idea. For the next month, I would send her photos of hotels and things to do there. She was really excited about it. I booked everything for her. Flights, hotels, things to do. The bill was astronomical. But she just said, so what? You never know when it's your last Christmas together. As the trip approached, all that was left was for her to get her passport renewed. Then, disaster. Despite our best efforts, the passport didn't arrive in time. As silly as it may seem, not getting to Whistler represented so much to my mother. She was desperate for a magical escape, and Whistler had come to represent an ideal, a dreamland. When it fell through, I swear something changed. She seemed resigned to something, as though she wasn't going to find the joy she once felt here anymore. On top of her feeling unwell at Disneyland, there was a strange energy at the end of 2022. Unusual things kept happening with her health. She developed an infection and had to go to the hospital in November. There, she was given opioids, which worried me. I didn't want to ask her or police her about it because I knew this would result in another massive fight. So I trusted that she would take what she needed and not abuse the pills. After her death, I learned from her toxicology report that she had, in fact, taken a therapeutic amount, and I felt incredibly proud of her. Things started cascading. She would constantly complain about her stomach, about feeling nauseated. She would drink lots of Pepto-Bismol, which was always by her bed. I could tell my sisters were worried, too. They'd often ask me, "Is Mama going to be okay?" I would say yes, but I didn't believe it. I think maybe my sisters knew, too. After Christmas, a Christmas that did indeed become our last together, we all went to Santa Ynez to ring in 2023. It was no Whistler. It was, in fact, a place we always went for New Year's, so it was more depressing than exciting, but at least we were together. My mom, my sisters, and I took horse rides through the beautiful valley. I watched my mother slowly get into communication with the horse, feel it out, learn its rhythm. She was so in tune with horses. Even if the horse was grumpy, she'd find a way to build a relationship with it. It was so moving to watch her intuit a horse's personality. On New Year's Eve, we found ourselves in a honky-tonk bar where a band was doing covers. At one point, they did a country version of Suspicious Minds, and afterward, my mom went up to congratulate them. The lead singer was a bit full of himself. He probably liked to look at himself in the backs of spoons, and he barely gave my mom the time of day, which she thought was hilarious. When she got back to our table, she was laughing. "Arrogant son of a bitch," she said. I said, "I don't think he knew who you were, Mom." After we finished watching the band, my sisters went to their room, and my mom and I snuck off to a spot next to the non-smoking hotel restaurant. And giggling like teenagers hiding from their parents, we lit up. I had quit smoking years ago, but I wanted to have this cigarette with my mom. Eventually, my dad came around the corner and lit a cigarette, too. The three of us stood there under the roof, keeping out of the light rain, smoking. As we smoked, my mother said, "Oh, that baby. I can't handle her. She fills me up and knocks me dead." "I know, sweet Sonny," my dad said. My mom's word fawn had become son, had become Sonny in our silly shared language. There in that moment, I found myself feeling so grateful that I still had both my parents. I didn't take it for granted. That was the last time I really hung out with my mom until we had dinner in LA together on January 8th, coincidentally her father's birthday. Just she and I, my husband and my girlfriends, which was common. She was unusually quiet, withdrawn in her own world. I kept trying to include her in the conversations, but she looked at me and said, "I'm going to go home." There was a sadness to her, and the same sense of resignation. I was worried. My husband and I walked her to her car. She seemed very soft, almost empty. And my mom was not a soft person. Something had left her. A couple days later, I went back to Vancouver where I was filming a show. I found myself checking in via text more than usual, but she was less responsive than she normally was. My worry deepened. On the morning of January 12th, my mom texted my dad and said, "Can you please help? My stomach's hurting worse than ever. Can you bring Tums?" I'd been having a beautiful morning with the baby. I had texted my mom the day before and she hadn't responded, which was really unlike her. When my dad called, I knew something bad had happened. "It's your mom," he said, "and it's not looking good." My heart stopped. By the time he had gotten to her with the Tums she'd asked for, the housekeeper had found her on the floor. "They think she's had a heart attack," he said. "She's in an ambulance now. They're trying to resuscitate her." I went right to the airport and got on the first flight I could back to LA. For the whole car ride and then while I was in the air, my dad and my husband were texting me. "They're at the hospital now. She's still alive. They've resuscitated her. She has a pulse now. They're doing a scan to see what happened." I had my best friend with me on the plane to help with Tupelo. At some point during the flight, my friend said to me, "People live through heart attacks all the time." I looked at her and said, "I don't think she's going to live through it. I don't think she wants to." We were flying somewhere over Yosemite, and I looked down at the wilderness below, covered with snow. Tupelo was screaming and crying by now, and she's not a big crier. Everyone notices that about her, that pretty much all she does is smile. We'll walk through the neighborhood and people will say, "Oh, look, she's smiling at me." And I always hold myself back from saying, "It's really nothing personal. She smiles at everyone." But sitting on that crowded plane, I could feel that my baby knew something terrible was happening. When Tupelo was still in utero, there had been a moment the doctor told us she was underweight. My mom said to me, "Talk to her spirit. Tell her to try and gain a little weight. She'll hear you." So I did. I put my hand on my surrogate's belly at lunch one day, and in my mind, I told Tupelo to try and gain a little bit more weight before her birth. Somehow, she ended up gaining the perfect amount of weight. Maybe it worked. On the airplane home, I felt like my mother was between two worlds. Being resuscitated, falling, resuscitated, falling. I wanted so badly to be there with her, spiritually at least, and tell her that I supported whatever she wanted to do. I closed my eyes and talked to her spirit just like I had Tupelo's. If you need to go, go. If you need to stay, stay. We were somewhere due west of Death Valley when the text from my dad stopped. I couldn't bear the silence for very long. I texted him, but I already knew. It was 5:18 p.m. when my father texted. She's in cardiac arrest again. Oh, God. At 5:19, he wrote, "Can you call me?" "No, I'm on the plane," I wrote. At 5:20, I wrote, "Is she dying?" My dad didn't respond for 4 minutes. I wrote again, "Did she die?" I waited. Then his reply arrived. "She passed on a few minutes ago, honey. Didn't want to tell you by text, but I'm worried it's going to hit the papers. I love you so much. I'm really sorry to tell you like this. I don't want you to be blindsided when you get off the plane." My father was my mom's biggest protector throughout her whole adult life. She had many friends that came and went, but he was there from when she was 17 until the moment she died. He was the last person with her. We were still half an hour from LA. Tupelo had finally calmed enough to sleep a little bit, and I quietly sobbed, trying not to disturb the passengers around me. The world I'd taken off from in Canada that morning was not the same one I landed in at LAX that night. I didn't recognize this strange new planet. It was already a place that for 2.5 years had been so painfully empty of my brother Ben-Ben, and now it was empty of my mother, too. I wondered how many times a heart can break. As we sped away from the airport, I remember seeing people walking in and out of a brightly lit 7-Eleven. Nothing had changed for them. Of course it had not. Time did its stretching and contracting thing again. Here we are again, I thought. I know this. When my brother died, I was hit with the realization that he was nowhere to be found on Earth. I could travel anywhere and never find him. No matter how far I flew, how far I drove, how far I walked, he was gone. I remember driving through Northern California and passing an immense expanse of empty farmland and thinking that he wasn't in there either. He could never be found, no matter how hard I looked. Now it was the same feeling with my mother. She was like a character from the Greek myths. She had human emotions, but she was such a force that sometimes I really thought if she focused hard enough, real thunderbolts would appear. Her power and strength frightened people. She had an uncanny ability to see right into your soul. And she was able to truly unconditionally love. She had definitely been reincarnated royal every time. My dad and I would joke that if God had ever asked her to come back not as a royal, she would have declined his offer. My mother was the only person who would say no to God. The night before the funeral service, close friends said goodbye to her in the chapel at Graceland. The next day we held the service at Graceland. All of her friends, everyone who ever loved her, attended, including people she hadn't seen in years. Everyone she had jettisoned before she fled to England, just everyone. A local choir sang. What began as an incredibly traumatic and painful morning ended in a celebratory dance party, just like the ones we used to have back in the day. The same people, the same songs. There was joy. We all felt she was there. I couldn't speak, so my husband read my eulogy, a letter to my mama. "Thank you for being my mother in this life. I'm eternally grateful to have spent 33 years with you. I'm certain I chose the best mother for me in this world, and I knew that as far back as I can remember you. I remember everything. I remember you giving me baths as a baby. I remember you driving me in my car seat listening to Aretha Franklin. I remember the way you'd cuddle me when I'd come to your bed at night and the way you smelled. I remember you taking me for ice cream after school in Florida. I remember you singing me and my brother lullabies at night and how you'd lay with us until we fell asleep. I remember how every time you'd leave town, you'd bring me a new tea set from Cracker Barrel. I remember all the notes you'd leave in my lunchbox every day. I remember the feeling I'd get when I'd see you picking me up from school and the way your hand felt on my forehead. I remember how it felt to be loved by the most loving mother I've ever known. I remember how safe it felt to be in your arms. I remember that feeling as a child, and I remember it 2 weeks ago on your couch. Thank you for showing me that love is the only thing that matters in this life. I hope I can love my daughter the way you loved me, and the way you loved my brother and my sisters. Thank you for giving me strength, my heart, my empathy, my courage, my sense of humor, my manners, my temper, my wildness, my tenacity. I am a product of your heart. My sisters are a product of your heart. My brother is a product of your heart. We are you, you are us, my eternal love. I hope you finally know how loved you were here. Thank you for trying so hard for us. If I didn't tell you every day, thank you. The service ended and night fell. My mom's casket was laid across a golf cart, just like the one her father had given her decades ago. The one that had given her her first taste of freedom. All of her closest friends and loved ones followed the golf cart and walked my mother from the chapel to the meditation garden in the backyard of Graceland. We laid her to rest next to my brother, across from her father.
My stories, they're not like anyone else's. They're endless. They're what most people haven't experienced. At the same time, I always think like, yeah, okay, every story is going to show I'm strong, I'm still here. That's going to be like the holy shit, I can't believe you survived that, and I can't believe you're still alive. That'll be what people take away from that. Or that I'm so strong, that's the thing I hear, which makes me crazy, because that makes me go, well, what for though? I'm strong, that doesn't do anything for me. Like, throw stuff at me and I'll get through it, but what does it matter? What does strength matter to me? It doesn't matter to me, strength. I think that my story, my autobiography, and all my stories and the things that happened in my life, I think that people will have gone through some of the same things and probably be like, that really helped me, which would be more interesting for me and more fulfilling for me, is to hear my book help people. And what I've endured through my life and what I've gone through helps people.